This is Pat Mundy interviewing Dr. Carl Helmicke, a longtime friend of mine who has taught history, literature, languages as a philologist and semanticist in several of the universities here in this country, including New York, Pennsylvania, Iowa, Colorado, and Texas. Dr. Helmicke, I understand that you were born in Germany and came to this country by yourself, a little boy. Would you tell us something of what you remember about Germany and some of your earliest recollections?
Well, I remember a few things, and possibly what I could talk about most would be talking about schools. I remember distinctly going to school the first time, how my mother took me, and I was kind of wondering what it would be all about. And of course there were other boys, and of course they separated boys and girls at the school fairs that night. There were other boys who cried and had a terrible time, so of course I tried to be brave and did all right, and I guess I had no trouble. At any rate, I remember my first definite impression had to do with the first report we got. It turned out that when they graded the members of the class, I was at the top of the class. And when I came home with that report, it didn't, of course, mean very much to me at the moment. My father and my grandfather both were very much surprised and pleased that they had such a brilliant son and a grandson, and they showed their surprise and approval by each giving me a Thaler. Now the German Thaler with a T really is the same in Low German as the English word dollar. The differences in the value. The Thaler is worth 75 cents, and the dollar, of course, is worth a dollar. But at any rate, here I felt very rich and had the two silver dollars in my possession for the first time. And so, of course, I decided that I would keep up my work and remain at the top of the class. And it happened that all through the first 4 years, which I spent in the public schools, I happened to be consistently the top ranking scholar in that particular class. And of course, my family was highly pleased, at least my father seemed to be, because he even bought me a regular school desk, which he put in the room, which was for our children in a large old house. And it was at that desk, of course, that I could, at any time, do my school work, the writing and reading and studying. And apparently I was pretty well adjusted to that, keeping up my record. Now, of course, the thing is that instead of going right straight through the schools as we do, from the first grade to the 12th grade, you have to make a choice at various times over there in the German schools, which brings about your having to go to different schools according to what you intend to do. Now there are some schools, the so-called gymnasium. I don't know why they call it gymnasium, because it's of course the same word as the one we use for gymnasium, and we use the word correctly. It means, of course, a place where you can practice wearing a minimum of clothes. Now, of course, that has nothing to do with going to that school, which was really the college or university preparatory type of school. So instead of going into the fifth grade of the public schools, you transfer to that particular type of school, which is an old classical school. This particular one, of course, had the very imposing Latin name, of the Gymnasium Martino Catarineo, which of course meant that it was a coming together of two older schools, one that had existed in St. Martin's Parish, and the other had existed in St. Catherine's Parish, which were later, when the Dukes of Brunswick, and I lived in the city of Brunswick, moved back into that city and made it the residence of the duchy, they took over these schools to combine them and took them under their wings, and it was quite an exclusive sort of a school, similar to the schools which in England they would call the public schools, like Eton and Harrow and Rugby and Merchant Taylor and all the rest of them. It was that type of school. And of course, where in England there were the old school tie, in these German schools, they have their school caps. Each cap has possibly a different shape. Certainly it has a different color for each grade. So you start out with a black cap and you graduate to a brown one and later on to a green one and to a blue one and a black velvet one is the last one, a great imposing looking sort of a thing. So of course we were always very proud of these caps. The only difficulty was that if you wore them on the street, you could be recognized as being students at that particular school. And of course there were those who didn't go to schools at that time, who were rather envious perhaps, and I can still remember how we were sometimes, several of us together walking down the street, were chased by these hoodlums and had to take refuge. I remember at one time we went by an old flour mill and we had to go in there and stay for an hour or more because these boys were outside besieging the place because they knew we were in there. At any rate, it was quite a distinction, of course, to go to one of these higher schools. And of course, we were very proud of the school because it was a very old one. It originated, really, because there was a quarrel between the clergy and the city council of this proud old city, which was one of the chief ones of the Hanseatic League. And so the city council had sent an emissary to the Pope to Rome to ask for a charter for a school which they could run rather than the clergy. And they came back with two charters, which were those that caused the establishment of St. Martin's Catholic School. But of course it was a Latin school, and emphasis was all on the study of Latin.
No, is that the cross?
Oh, they had other subjects. They studied, of course, what they called natural history, or the study of mathematics. And, of course, eventually they studied other languages, because, of course, languages were much emphasized in a small countries like the European countries, of course. You're almost bound to run into somebody who speaks a different language across a frontier, and so it's highly desirable that you know the German, of course, French, or English. So, in what corresponds to our fifth grade, which was the first grade of this gymnasium, they started Latin. And then what would correspond to our seventh grade was the grade in which they started French. And what would correspond to our ninth grade was the grade in which they started English. So, of course, you had all these things. And then, of course, being college preparatory, university preparatory, the old universities, of course, had the classical four faculties of theology, philosophy, law, and medicine. So, of course, there were always those who were going to be theologians, and they, in the last, the highest grades, would study Hebrew also in school, so that they were prepared to deal with the Hebrew as they ran across it in the biblical studies. That was strictly a college preparatory school. There were others. But next door to this school was another similar school, but it was called a Real Gymnasium. The so-called Reale, of course, meant the more practical things. That is, they didn't study Latin. They started with French and went into English, and they chose the important things. They paid much more attention to mathematics and chemistry and physics and things like that. And of course, those graduates went to institutions which would correspond to our Institutes of Technology, like in Massachusetts or California or Georgia, like Georgia Tech, for instance. Or else they were there for forestry or mining, which also, you see, required chemistry and botany and scientific studies. And of course, there was a good deal of prestige connected with studying agriculture and forestry, because so many of the old feudal nobility, of course, owned large estates, and of course, mining men had to know something about agriculture. So the study of agriculture was really quite an aristocratic thing over there. But you had to go to the right kind of a school to get the preparatory course. And the same thing with forestry. It is strange that that relatively small country, the central history of France, and highly industrialized country now, still has one-fourth of its total area covered by forest. And the forest, of course, is revenue producing. But of course, in order to produce revenue, they have to prepare well-prepared foresters. And they would go to this Real type of gymnasium because they practiced real practical things. There were other similar higher schools which you could enter where you could take business courses. Or they also had so-called seminaries where you could prepare to become a teacher in the public schools. Of course, the teachers in these gymnasia were all university graduates, so there was a difference in the preparation of the teachers as you find them there. So you enter that school and you feel, of course, very proud of yourself because you realize that you are one of those who eventually will probably have the opportunity to occupy a responsible position in that particular capacity. So, possibly that is the main things that I remember. Of course, the vacation periods are arranged somewhat differently from the way ours are. We have our vacation concentrated during the 3 months approximately of the summer. They're scattered all through the year. And in the German school setting, the school year begins at Easter time. So the first quarter of the year would be from Easter until summer. And then would come the so-called big vacation, which occurred during the month of July, 4 weeks. And then the second quarter would come from 1st of August on until fall, Michaelmas time, corresponding to our Thanksgiving period, because there they too have the celebration, except of course that instead of eating turkey, the turkey is an American food, and consequently of course did not originally exist in Europe, although it was been imported, but the typical bird in Europe, Western Europe, is the goose. So of course you can find big flocks of geese being driven on the road sometimes, especially in the fall, when that is around Thanksgiving, what corresponds to our Thanksgiving. During that period, of course, they are brought to town and everybody has roast goose for the celebration of the anniversary turkey at that particular time. Well, those were the following quarters, the second quarter, and then the third quarter runs from then until Christmas. And then I have a Christmas vacation, of course, to take care of the Christmas celebration. And then comes the fourth quarter, which runs from Christmas until Easter time. And there is another vacation at Easter time. So in the constant number of days, they have about the same number of days of vacation as we have, but they're scattered around differently. They have more vacation, but shorter ones each time. There's the school year. Now, of course, there's always the problem of what we do with the vacation. We usually spend our vacations on an island in the North Sea. The island is Spiekeroog. And we chose that island, of course, because it happened that my grandfather, my mother's father, had been a sea captain, retired. And of course, he liked to go to the seashore. And being retired, of course, he could go whenever he wanted to, and he spent most of the summer on this island. And then during July, in our vacation period, of course, we went out there and spent the time on the beach, similar to what we have here at Harbor Island. Being on an island, of course, we were very much interested in the waters and the ships. Now, of course, since my grandfather was a sailor, and of course had spent his day in sailor, as a matter of fact, he was shipwrecked at the time of the Civil War at Cape Hatteras, and had to take two boats, and the boat which he was in charge of was picked up by an American warship, and he was brought into New York City, and he spent some time in New York City during the Civil War. Then afterwards, of course, he came home, he was married, and he went into business, and he served in the Army. He was an artillery officer. And during the Franco-German War, he was in charge of a prison camp. And I remember for a long time, at Christmas time, we had some decorations which had been on the Christmas tree, which he and his committee had prepared for the French prisoners in 1870. And some of these were saved, and every year they were on our Christmas tree also. But I suppose because of my grandfather and the association with the ocean, I became very much interested in ships of all kinds. And we did naturally, some boating and sailing. It would be similar as sailing in the Laguna Madre here, back of the islands and the places in the main. Went back and forth there to these little harbors along the coast. And of course, we spent much time on the beach, which was sandy. And we dug in there and built castles and went swimming in there. Of course, there the tide is fairly high, difference of about 3 or 4 feet between high tide and low tide. So at low tide, the water was way up. And that was deep but close to shore. But further out, there was a sandbar. And on this sandbar, seals would lie. And we would wade through the water and go out to the bar and watch those seals play out there.
What kind of seals were there?
Well, of course, for the rest of the world, we were bathing suits when we went swimming, and I suppose we anticipated the swim. We probably went out in a bathing suit a good share of the time. We stayed generally, as my mother, we controlled our sister-in-law, stayed at a hotel on this particular place, or rather stayed at the cottage which belonged to the hotel. We had several rooms in there where we stayed, and then we had our meals at the big dining room at the hotel. But that was the summer vacation on the island. Now in the fall, generally, we went to visit, my great-grandmother, my mother's father's stepmother, because his own mother had died and my great-grandfather had married again. He had been a superintendent of schools of this town, town of the first five people.
What
was the time? Town of Sherman. And, of course, being a superintendent of schools and those things, he had quite a sizable library. And when my mother had gone back to Germany the last time, she had brought me back a few specially selected books which had been in my great-grandfather's library. She brought it back to me. I still have it in my library now. But we went to visit our grandmother, of course, there. I know she lived on a beautiful street right off before the city park. She and an old servant and her spitz dog lived in this apartment. And when we went there, of course, we stayed there. She had a guest room, so we could well take care of us there. And we just a little bit down the block, one of her cousins lived, and he had a big cattle business, bought, sold cattle, mainly. He also had horses and sheep, but it was quite an agricultural establishment down the line there. And, the youngest daughter was about our age, and we carried with her. And she had a carriage of her own with a horse and a driver who would take her apart. And this boy, this driver, was the son of the coachman for the parents and grandparents of this particular family. There were so many of these old retailers. In my own family, my great-grandfather had a coachman, Fernand was his name, and he had been with my great-grandfather, and then he had been with my grandfather, and now was with my father. And he had a little boy who was perhaps too young to be a coachman as yet, and we used to play with them. But here are these family retainers, which you keep for generations. Many times I've known of cases where a mother would give, as a wedding present, her old maid to her daughter, so that this maid, now quite an old woman, could take care of this young girl and help her establish a household. In other words, it was supposed to be a very precious gift if the mother gave up her old servant and gave it to her daughter. But they continued back through the generations. So we always love to go to my grandmother, especially since Anita, this little girl, having our own carriage, we could drive out into the country to visit on the various estates out there. You see, it's like the county families in England. You have these estates all over. We used to go to these places. I remember particularly one called Yorkshire. And it was a great big place built around a courtyard in the form of a square. There was a driveway, we went into it, and there was a big courtyard where the farm machinery could be stored. And on one side was the residence, and on the other side were the stables, and on the other side were the wagon sheds and the foresight where they were barns and so on, and it's quite an aesthetic. And the thing is, you come up to the front door, which faced this yard. And then you went through the house, or went up, or through what we probably call the back door, and then you came into a park, back at the house. Now, the thing is, these parks are quite, of course, the old, probably, they've existed for decades, if not centuries. I had one cousin living out there, who had married a man whose family had lived in the same place for the last 700 years. So, you see, that was pretty well established. And the park they had been worked on for generation after generation. And usually they had gravel paths running through there. And these paths would be lined with bushes, usually gooseberries and currant bushes. I remember especially the currant bushes because they always like to eat the currants and eat them as jelly. And currant jelly is still my favorite jelly now. I remember those especially. And then, of course, fruit trees, apples and pears and plums and cherries were growing there. And at the end of the park, generally, was a kind of a garden house where you could sit in the open. And maybe have supper or something like that. So that's always very nice. Another statement I remember, belonging to another cousin, located in a little town near there, the town of Elvis, which was, this particular place was on the edge of the Harz Mountains. And the house apparently extended from the main street back a long ways, and it was similarly built around the courtyard where they had various farming places. This man incidentally bought home woven linens from the people, and apparently was a wholesaler in home woven materials, and he had some of it manufactured probably in the sheets or whatever it was, built it. At any rate, they had that in the house itself. At the back of that was this garden. And at the very end of this particular garden, there was part of the old city wall which had persisted. And right there was a big tower. And my uncle had fixed it up. There was a stairway on the inside now, which he had built, of course. And you could sit on top of that tower and look over the country in the summertime. And right next to this tower was an old gate. And then, of course, on the other side is what originally was the moat surrounding the tower. It's now overgrown with bushes. And beyond that was, of course, the level stretch of huge years, because they kept, of course, the immediate territory outside of the walls clear, so they could see all the bush. And this now was a meadow, and on this meadow they had pegged out these bolts, unrolled bolts of linen, which were bleached out there. And so you go out there and you see the green grass, and this row after row after row of these white stretches of linen, which were being bleached out in that particular place. So we always like to go out there. So we did travel all over the country and saw these various estates. Were familiar with what was going on. There were others that we went to. I remember one where the man used to take me hunting. He did the hunting, of course, and I just went along. He'd shoot a deer, and then the problem was of getting it home. So I remember one time he had shot a deer and he dragged it out to the road. And there was an old woman coming along with a carrier basket on her back. And he hired her to carry that deer in that basket to the village. That's where he got it home.
Did you
want
anything else
with
that deer?
Pardon?
Did you hunt anything else besides deer?
Well, of course, in season they run rabbits, and then they have birds or perhaps quail, I guess they would have there, possibly pheasants. But the thing I remember, of course, is shooting this deer out there. One of my uncles had a summer place a little ways out of town, and we used to go out there over the weekend sometimes and stay. And it was a stretch of quite dense oak forest and a lot of shrubbery growing underneath the trees. And there was a spring back there where we got our water. And this spring, of course, attracted the deer. So we could sit on the back porch of this house and watch the deer drinking at this particular spring. So we were always interested in deer. Of course, hateful actually to see them shot eventually, but I guess that was inevitable.
I understand that your family lived in a house in Germany that was built many, many years ago. Could you tell us something about it?
Yes. It was a very, very old house. The date on the front door, which was carved in there, was 1491. And that's very old. The story is that at one time it was a monastery. And after the Reformation, of course, the monks were gone, because that area is Protestant now, and the family was sold for other purposes. And for a time, there must have been a tile factory there, because at one time my father found a lot of Dutch tile, white with the blue design on them, depicting scenes from the Old Testament of the Bible. Very interesting, and of course, he utilized them in lining the walls of a dining room with these tiles. So our dining room was tiled with these old tiles. Also, this old house, big one though, of course, well preserved, well built. One of these exposed timber type houses. And it had the reputation that there were dwarfs in the basement of the house. So when I went to school as a little boy, kids used to come to me in the schoolyard and say very anxiously, "Is it true that you have dwarfs in your basement?" And I would say, "Oh, yes, 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 dwarfs in the house." The fact was, of course, that this place having been a monastery at one time was probably connected with another monastery in that city. At any rate, there must have been an underground passage which went from the basement of this place to another. In the basement, I know I've seen it, there was a big oaken door nailed up and protected with strips of iron. Now, of course, completely blocking the passage, but when my father had an opening one time, there was actually the beginning of a passage starting out there, tunnel, which in the meantime probably caved in. So, of course, it was quite possible that this house, which supposedly was empty, say, suddenly had people in it. They had come through this passage from that other convent building under the under the ground. And so here was this period which covered a lot of territory. My great grandfather had fought the place. He was an interesting character. He came of an old peasant family who owned land on the west edge of the Harz Mountains. And of course, as customary over there, the oldest son always inherits the farm. And so if they had younger sons, they had to be taken care of some other way. If they're not ambitious, they probably just become hired men of their older brothers. Or sometimes they acquire a few acres of land and are bachelors. That's where the term bachelor is supposed to come from. Men who are not well enough off to marry, and at the same time are not exactly poor, and live there on their little few acre farm all by themselves, batching it, as we say. Others again, who are more ambitious perhaps, either marry rich farm girls, and in that way acquire a farm through their wives, or else they go to the large city and go into business. Well, this great-grandfather of mine, being the second son, did go to the city. And of course they helped him out to get started, so he got started in the real estate business. And ended up as being one of the big real estate owners in that particular city, owning land and owning houses, and of course eventually owning a big lumber yard, where he had the material for building houses on his land. And it's in that way that he got into the lumber business, which eventually, of course, also attracted my father, who was a specialist in lumber. At any rate, he had bought this house, and he had lived there, and his oldest daughter was my grandmother, my mother's mother, and his much younger only son, of course, inherited the property later on. He was about the same age as my mother. They were brought up together. They lived in the same house. Being big, of course, there were different apartments in that very large house. Even though they were really uncle and niece, they always thought of each other as cousins. And, of course, the children, the two daughters, of these, of this man, who were really my aunts, that were really of my age again, were some of our playmates when we were small children. They, of course, didn't live there because apparently my grandmother and her husband had inherited this house and they lived there. And then when my mother was married, she and her husband, my father, lived there, and I remember being having a bedroom up there in that old house. Of course, it is gone now because during the Second World War it was bombed, and when my wife and I went back there a few years ago and wanted to see it, I wanted to show it to her, we came to the place where the house had been. And there was just a deep hole in the ground. It's gone.
Okay. How did you come to have the sword collection from your family?
Well, I think I've mentioned that in 37, 38, I was an exchange professor at the University of Berlin. And during vacation, of course, I traveled around to see as much as I could of the country. And I went to visit one of my uncles, who incidentally lived in the house where we had lived. He had bought it from my father when my father had come to this country. And I went to see my uncle, and he of course showed me around. And we went upstairs on the top floor of this very large, I think there were four floors to it, very large old house. And there was a room up there which at one time was to have been my private study. And so, of course, he wanted to show me, because that is where my great-grandfather's library was stored, and all pictures and various collections. In other words, it was almost a little museum up there. So he took me up there, and I saw a number of weapons, guns, swords, and knives, and whatnot, in this room. And I, of course, being interested in those things, since my father had been an army officer for a time, I asked about it. He said, well, after all, they are yours, so if you want them, why don't you take them? And I said, would you really give them to me? Yes. So I had it packed up and had it sent to this country, and I had them. And one of the swords, of course, is particularly interesting, because it had been used by one of my great-grandfathers, in the Battle of Waterloo. We know that because the date on the sword is 1811, and it was made in the French arms factory of Klingenthal, and apparently had been captured during the Napoleonic Wars, and had been reissued to this outfit commanded by the Duke of Brunswick. And the Duke, the Black Duke, as he's called in history generally, the Black Duke of Brunswick, a relative of the English royal family, of course, and the Brunswick contingent was with Wellington's army, and the Black Duke, incidentally, was killed a couple of days before the Battle of Waterloo at the Battle of Quatre Bras, were, and the English usually don't mention this fact, the English were defeated by Napoleon and withdrew to Waterloo, and it was there, of course, or rather a little bit to the south of Waterloo, that the battle was fought. The overseer of the German troops being defeated at Ligny and having to struggle to get to help Wellington, but we never hear of the Battle of Quatre Bras, which of course I remember because of the fact that my own people fought in that battle, and also because the then Duke of Brunswick was actually killed leading his troops in that particular battle. But anyway, that's how I got my collection started. Then, of course, they said my grandfather was an officer, artillery officer. And my father was an army officer with the infantry, and they all had swords, of course, and swords were available, and eventually I acquired them, and I had them. And there were some guns that, as we know, belonged to my great-grandfather. And while I wouldn't dare shoot the thing now, I have it as a very interesting old relic as a part of my collection. These old houses in these old cities, in their day, they're rich and they're powerful. Members of the Adriatic League, as I've said before, were built, of course, very spaciously. And there was always plenty of room everywhere. And so, of course, it was possible to have in such a place what was generally known as the wash or laundry kitchen. Now, the word kitchen, of course, means the place where something is being cooked or boiled. And, of course, what they boiled in there was the clothes. So they had built in this particular room, which was about, you know, it was almost the size of this room. In one corner, they had two brick fireplaces or stoves built in with two big copper kettles set in them, in which the clothes could be boiled. Now, of course, the thing is that the importance of the family is measured by the number of times they wash in the course of the year. The fewer the number, the higher up socially you are. If you have to wash every day, you're poor. But if you can keep it off 6 weeks or a month, then you must be pretty wealthy, because you have to have enough linen and enough towels and enough everything else to keep going that length of time. But of course, by the time you get around to have a washing, it gets to be quite a celebration. So in this particular case, my mother always had to hire two women who spent 3 days washing and boiling the clothes and taking them up in the attic. And these, you'll see pictures of some of these old houses. They're not very high. The actual house is only about 2 stories high. And then there's a steep roof 5 stories above that. So the whole thing is 7 stories high, maybe. But the stories up under the roof are for storage of all kinds. And so, of course, that's where you take your clothes to have to dry. And as a matter of fact, my mother used to rent these places to other people to hang their clothes to dry when they came to do that. So, of course, it was always a big celebration. Well, not a celebration, but a big to-do when the washwomen came, because they washed. But, of course, they had to be fed quite well. And so it was always a matter of saying that these washwomen had plenty to eat.
Do you have any idea what wages they might have earned?
Well, they probably didn't get too much from our point of view, but it's all relative. Apparently, they were paid pretty well in accordance with the wage rates that prevailed there at that time. But it always struck me as funny that you measure the importance of people by the small number of times they wash clothes in the household. But they had the special room where they just went there and everything had to give way to the washing. Everything was upset for the time being. And then, of course, afterwards, the things had to be ironed and so on. And they got a special woman in to do the ironing, or at least to do the fancy ironing, like shirts and collars. Things that had to be starched and so on, they had to be specially ironed. So it was always quite a to-do. Now, it was also a custom to do your own butchery. In other words, in the fall, these people would buy a hog and have it butchered. And I've seen this great big hog being hauled up on the pulley and hanging there, being aired apparently for a while, and then eventually some butcher who did that kind of work would come along and cut the thing up, and they chop the meat up and make sausages and fix the hams and hang the sausages in the chimney so that they could be smoked. So we always had smoked sausages and hams about the house. Remember, of course, that this was before the days of refrigerators, and only the most elite individuals, you might say, had gotten around to getting ice boxes. I mean, my mother had one, and she was very proud of it, because not very many people had. The same way that people were proud of their telephone, because very few people had telephones at that particular time. Of course, everybody who could afford it had servants. And so we usually had 2 or 3 or 4 of mine. We had a kitchen maid who did the work about the kitchen. My mother usually had to finish the touches to the actual cooking, but this girl would wash the dishes and clean the vegetables and so on and so forth, set the table. And then there was a chambermaid who cleaned the house. And then, of course, as we were smaller, we had a maid for the children to look after them. So sisters were there on bicycles, of course. My father and mother used to go out early in the morning to go bicycle riding, while the nursemaids, of course, took care of the children. And, of course, the meal situation was different from the way we have it in this country. We used to speak of 3 spur meals a day. Well, over there, they had 6 meals a day. But, of course, they're not all square. So our breakfast, the European breakfast, is very, very simple. I know we children had usually a cup of cocoa, or 2 cups, whatever we wanted, and fresh rolls, which were baked. And every morning, the baker's boy, of course, would bring the fresh rolls in a bag, which he hung on the doorknob of the front door, and collected the bag, which he took back to be filled with rolls to be brought back the next morning. So there was a standing order for fresh rolls. They were good rolls, too. And that was breakfast. Now, sometimes you got an egg. And so there were 2 kinds of breakfast. Breakfast, and breakfast with egg. Of course, you see these egg cups. It's a boiled egg, generally, and you knock the top of it off. It's usually not hard boiled, but kind of liquid, and you dig in there with the spoon and eat it. Anyway, that's breakfast. So, of course, that's just to get you started. And then, in the middle of the morning, the 7th meal, corresponds more or less to the American breakfast. In Germany, you know, call it Gabelfrühstück. And in French, they also call it Déjeuner à la fourchette, which means the same thing. In other words, a breakfast, a meal, at which you have to use a fork to eat with. Which meant, of course, that probably you had fried eggs or a salad or ham, or bacon, or whatever it might be, anyway, something that you had eaten with a fork, and they call it a fork breakfast in the middle of the morning. Now, of course, if you went to school or went to work, you couldn't come home for a nap, you took a sandwich with you. So children going to school always had a little container in which they carried that sandwich, which they took to school and ate during recess. That was their middle of the morning breakfast. And then, of course, that would be the noon meal. Now, of course, just as with us, the custom exists there too, that some people have the big meal in the middle of the day, and some people have the big meal in the evening. But in the middle of the day, usually it's somewhere between 12 and 2 o'clock. It varies, sometimes as late as 2. And frequently, if it isn't a big meal, they just have, lunch. Sandwiches, cold cuts, something like that, that they have a temperature. Now, of course, you can have the full meal, they would have the roast and all that, which is the really same kind of meal generally, as far as the big meals are concerned. And then in the middle of the afternoon, at 4 o'clock, they have coffee. Coffee, and usually pastry, or cake or something. And pastry, that's a good pastry, I think, too. What do they call it? Danish pastry, Austrian pastry, and so on. The Austrians have the reputation for doing particularly good along those lines. But then they have these various types of pastry that is eaten at that time. And even when they're working, I remember being out in the country, stayed at the Scottish after that earlier, being out with the people working in the fields cutting the grain. Of course, that was before the days of mowing machines, and they're coming with a scythe. Man goes along with the scythe, cuts the grain, and behind him, usually a girl comes and picks up the grain, ties it in a bundle, and puts it up in the shops where it can dry. At any rate, 4 o'clock comes along, and the boss comes along, says, here, there's the ledge, let's go and have our 4 o'clock. And they actually have a name for it, they call it eating for the fourth time. That's what they call it. The boss calls out, hey, Fairmont eating. And everybody drops and comes up and gets his lunch. Sandwiches, whatever it is, something to drink. And then, of course, they quit work at sundown or thereabouts, long days. But then supper in the evening, which might be any time from 7 o'clock on to 9 o'clock noon.
Oh,
you had sending in Mexico. I remember there, what do they call it? Cena, I believe they call it in Mexico. And at first, when I was down there going to college, we used to come home at 6 o'clock because we were accustomed to eating supper at 6, nothing doing. And we'd have to wait around, wait around. And then about 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, they'd call us for supper. Late. Of course, the souper, the French word, supper, really means something where you eat soup. That meant the dinner came at noon, of course, in the evening, it was the soup. And of course, the French had soup pot on the stove all the time. And, you start out on Sunday with chicken, and what's left over from the chicken, the bones, on, you put it into the pot and boil it, and it starts out with chicken soup. And then many during the week you have beef and whatnot, and stuff that's left over from that goes into the pot too. And by the end of the week, of course, you might have beef sauce in the pot. The pot au feu, the French call it, the pot au feu. Similar things, of course, in Germany. But those are the meals, more or less elaborate, of course, depending on the family and all that. Such thing. And naturally, since there are so many times when you have preserved meat, sausage or ham or something like that, it's a good thing to have your own supply available rather than to have to go to the butcher. Now, of course, there are butcher shops, and generally, still, they separate the butcher, which sells beef and mutton, lamb, and another butcher who sells pork products. They're very rare. They have the same thing in the same butcher shop. Now, in France, of course, they go one step farther because they don't object to horse meat. So in fact, they also have butcher shops where they sell horse meat. So you have 3 different kinds in France, and you have at least 2 different kinds in Germany, where you can get to them. But of course, if possible, you have your own supply by having your own pig killed. Usually they have a beef, but usually a pig, that is, butcher. Or sometimes a sheep. I remember my father at one time bought my sister and me, each a sheep, and we kept it about the place, and they wandered around there, and we were very fond of our sheep, of course. But of course, I got the idea that sheep ought to be pretty good to ride. After all, you rode horses, why shouldn't you ride sheep? But of course, here was my own sheep, and I wasn't going to take any chances with my sheep, so I tried riding my sister's sheep, and unfortunately must have broken the poor animal's back or hurt it anyway. Then I had to butcher the poor animal shortly thereafter. Always blamed the meat for him, of course, his death. And then, of course, knowing that it was this particular sheep, I remember how I just couldn't eat it. And somehow I had been very fond of lamb since. In other words, you sort of keep that sort of thing in your mind all through your life.
Carl, I understand that you came to the United States when you were about 11 or 12 years old. Did your life change radically then?
Well, it changed to some extent. Of course, my father had come here at the invitation of a cousin of his, who had bought a tract of forest, and he knew that my father was an expert on lumber, and he had brought him over here to inspect this forest to see whether it was worth cutting, but then it was worth buying. That's how he came over in the first place. He came alone. But he liked it. And so several months later he decided that maybe he'd like to stay over here, go into business here, and do stuff for his family. And so more or less accidentally he came to this country. Because at the time we had planned, perhaps, to go to Sweden, where my father had bought some land. He was going to do some lumbering up there, south of Gothenburg, on the western coast of Sweden. But instead of going there, of course, he stayed in this country. And he was connected with the furniture factories in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which of course was the furniture city at that time. I understand now so much of the furniture business was moved to the Carolinas, but at that time Grand Rapids was the very center. And of course there were these various furniture factories, and I know my father bought lumber, the kind of lumber that they needed, for half a dozen of the furniture factories there. And he traveled, or he was gone, 2-3 weeks each month buying, looking for the kind of lumber that he wanted, mahogany or oak and chestnut or whatever they used. And then, of course, it was artificially dried. And lumber curious, I know his office, always had great big charts in there which showed how each kill was progressing as to the dry, and it dried the dry water just to the right amount of moisture coming from it or whatever. At any rate, we lived in Grand Rapids most of the time. We're connected, and my father is connected with furniture business. My mother, of course, was doing various clubs. I remember going to dancing class at the St. Cecilia Club, which I suppose today it was a musical society. At any rate, it was one of the clubs, and they had dancing classes for the children of the members. My mother was active in some of those clubs. So. And when she first came to this country, of course, she was found to be quite different. She had been told a lot about democracy in this country, whatever democracy is. One of the things that she had been told was that, of course, here there was no class distinction. Everybody was just as good as everybody else. And so, among other things, if you hired a washwoman, you would have to have her.